From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with writer Pat Conroy. His autobiographical novels, The Prince of Tides and The Great Santini, are based on how his domineering, abusive father damaged the rest of the family. Also today, I speak with the Irish rock musician Pierce Turner. His new debut solo album was co-produced by Philip Glass. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the cast recording of Into the Woods, Stephen Sondheim's current Broadway hit. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses a book that collects foreign words and phrases for which there are no easy English translations. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Pat Conroy is the author of the current bestseller, The Prince of Tides, and the novel, The Great Santini. Both are based on Conroy's relationship with his domineering father, who was a Marine. In the film adaptation of The Great Santini, Robert Duvall starred as a Marine fighter pilot who runs his family as if they were under his command in the military. The Prince of Tides is told from the perspective of a high school coach who's on the verge of divorce. His twin sister, a feminist poet, has attempted suicide. To help her piece her life together, he must examine how his father's abusive behavior emotionally crippled the entire family. Conroy is the author of two more autobiographical novels which have been made into films. The Lords of Discipline draw on his experiences in military college. The Water is Wide, the basis of the film Conrack, is taken from Conroy's experiences teaching in a two-room schoolhouse on an island off the South Carolina coast. I spoke with Pat Conroy about some of the experiences in his own life which he's drawn on for his novels. He told me how difficult life with his father could be.
Dad mistook, for some reason, unbeknownst to me, he mistook his family for a platoon of Marines. I mean, the exact same thing he brought to the disciplining of a squadron, a battalion, a platoon, he brought to the disciplining of his children. He ran the house. He had Saturday morning inspections for us. He had white glove inspections for us as kids.
What would you have to do?
Well, he would, you know, simply, you know, we'd have to stand by the door at attention, and Dad would come in and flip quarters on the beds. And, you know, he did that whole thing, and I think partially good-humoredly and partially because he didn't know how else to relate to a family.
Did he bark out orders to you?
Of course. I mean, Dad, you know, Dad's friendliest tone was a scream.
Did you have to address him in a deferential way?
Well, in fact, Dad, I did not explain this in the book at all, but my father modestly referred to himself as the Great Santini when we were growing up. And he took it, I later learned, he had seen a high-wire aerialist when he was a boy. And he was up doing acrobatics in his airplane. When he came down one time, when he was a young lieutenant, he said, "I was better than the Great Santini today." And some of the other pilots heard it, and the nickname stuck. So the Great Santini was how he liked being referred to by his children. He would line up his seven children, and there was this ritual we'd go through. And he would say, "Who's the greatest of them all?" And we, the seven, would say, "You are, O Great Santini." And he would say, "Who knows all, hears all, and sees all? You do, O Great Santini." So this was a ridiculous way I was raised.
What would happen if you violated his orders?
He disobeyed him. He would knock you around, and you would not do it again. It was dangerous to cross Dad at that time.
Did you actually have to sing the Marine hymn on family outings?
Oh, sure.
Like the family does in the novel?
I can sing it to you right now. I mean,
go ahead.
This is no, the Marine Corps hymn is like the family anthem. I mean, we've, in all Marines, I mean, when I meet kids in the Marine Corps, that all of us have gone through this thing. It is when I find out that they also grew up in the Marine, they will say to each other, "Semper Fi," and we'll know, it's almost like a code word, a password between Marines and Marine kids all over the world.
What role did he have for your mother and for your sister, since, you know, if the model of the family was the Marines are a male group, so what were they supposed to be doing?
Well, I don't think my father noticed that he had daughters. I think, you know, part of the damage of the childhood was, I simply don't think they were acknowledged as human beings at all. Or, you know, one of the reasons I became a cook later on in my life was I was not allowed to cook an egg. And the girls all learned how to cook. The girls all learned how to sew. And the roles were so clear and differentiated that, and there was no, you could not deviate from that at all. And I think it especially damaged my sisters because there was nothing they could do to get my father's attention, to win his approval. They could not play sports. They could not do these other things. They could not be tough. They could not be macho. And so I think they suffered just from sheer neglect, if nothing else.
What were you expected to do when you were young to prove your masculinity?
Dad signed me up for football, basketball, and baseball every season of my life and never asked me if I wanted to play it or not.
Did you want to play it?
You know, eventually I got to like it. But I remember at first, football scared me to death.
One of the climactic scenes in the book and in the movie is when the son and the father are playing basketball together, and the son is about to win for the first time. And just as he's shooting the winning basket, the father, I think, punches him in the stomach. Like, he can't stand that his son is about to beat him for the first time.
All my brothers and sisters have stories about Dad like this. I remember when my sister was about to beat him in checkers for the first time, he knocked a board over. I mean, Dad was one of these people that simply could not lose. You know, he could not stand it. When a kid was beating him, he would go crazy. When the child came to that moment, which, you know, you have to come to. I mean, Dad played old maids like he played football. I mean, he just simply had to win every single thing, every single time.
Do you think that that's had a crazy effect on you in your later years?
It's had a crazy effect on my entire family. Yeah. I mean, we've all had to, you know, live with this particular legacy of, you know, my brother and sister and I get together, and it's an articulate group and a very funny group. And we talk about it constantly. What damage? What happened? How is it affecting you now? Can you control your temper? How do you treat your wife? How do you treat your husband? How do you treat your family? How do you treat your kids? And we're constantly having dialogues about this, of what effect Dad had and Mom had on our own lives now.
In a lot of families, there really is a legacy of violence if one of the parents is prone to hitting someone in the family. That's sometimes a habit that's passed on to the kids, even if they don't share that kind of violent streak.
I was in an adolescent psychology class at Citadel when the guy said, if you had a mother who was beaten, there's a great chance you'll beat your wife. And if you were beaten as a child, there's a terrific chance you're going to be a child beater yourself. The line changed my life because I thought of some poor woman I hadn't even met walking around the United States or the world, not knowing she's going to be beaten up by me, and these kids unborn, not knowing they were going to be born into the family of a child beater just because I was. So it really did have a great effect on me.
So what'd you do?
I told myself I was not going to beat my wife or children, and I haven't, which does not mean I've been a great husband or father, but I hadn't hit him.
Your father used to beat your mother?
Oh, yeah.
Did the kids try to stand up for her?
Oh, sure, we tried to stand up. It's very hard when your father's 220 pounds and you're 60 pounds. I noticed that we did not do much good.
Did she defend him for it?
What she would do, and which is the Prince of Tides, is a lot about my mother. What my mother would do, after Dad would hit one of the kids, or hit two of the kids, hit all the kids, hit her, she would usually get in the car, we'd drive out, she'd be saying, I'm going to divorce him, I'm never going back. We'd cheer. There'd be this incredible solidarity of these seven children, this one woman going out. Of course, because she was a woman in the 50s and 60s, where was she going to go? What was she going to do? How was she going to feed these seven children? Naturally, she had to go back. But what she would do, we'd go back and she'd say, that didn't happen. And she would invoke family loyalty and she would say, what you just saw happen did not happen. And so we grew up as this family of deniers, and people who knew us for years were stunned when The Great Santini came out, because we had this appearance of being this happy, large, smiling family. We taught to smile, put the best face forward. And so when the book came out of Dad swatting us around the room, no one believed me.
So that kind of revisionism in the family would prevent you from even sharing confidences with good friends about what happened?
No, and I never told a friend that I was hit when I was growing up.
It's a big burden to keep to yourself.
I think so. You know, I didn't know it at the time because it was the only life I'd ever led. And I had no idea that it was any different than any other family. And now my sister knew it. My sister, when she was about six, said, Mom and Dad are crazy. And I have no idea how she came to this conclusion, but she was saying they were crazy from the time she was a little girl.
You had said that your family denied that any of this abuse happened in the family, but you put some of it in The Great Santini in both the novel and in the movie, and it was there for the world to see. I mean, it was pretty evident that it was autobiographical. How did they deal with that, They couldn't deny it anymore.
Well, we had an odd thing happen in the Family Chronicle. As soon as this, I didn't tell anybody the Great Santini's being written. I was just writing this thing, and it was causing me, you know, because once you say this is true, and you start naming the beast that hurts you, so I started doing this, other truths come out. You know, how am I leading my own life? What am I denying? Since I brought such great powers of denial into my adult life, what am I not doing as a husband? What am I not doing as a father? And the whole thing started unraveling with me. That once I kept it up close to the chest, I could hold it all in. But once I started letting it out, it all started coming out. So when the book came out, my mother stunned us all by leaving my father. I think 3 months before the book came out, she left my father the day he retired from the Marine Corps. They had a parade and march, and she came home and left.
Do you think that was because the evidence had been clearly presented?
So. I think it was. I don't know what it was. I mean, she should have left him the second or third day of marriage, tops. I mean, she should have been gone. If she had any survival instincts, any insight, she should have been gone. But she was 18, I think, when she married, so she's a kid. I think she just had gotten tired of it. And once he'd gotten out of the Marine Corps, once she had done that, most of the kids were raised, she just said she was not doing this anymore. And she took off. Then the book comes out chronicling this abuse. And my mother simply took the book and gave it to the presiding judge at the divorce trial and said, this is what happened. So it was my first introduction to the difference between life and art and how they sometimes interact with each other.
Did the judge accept that as evidence?
Well, he didn't accept it as evidence, but he read it.
How did your parents feel about being portrayed by stars?
They simply loved it. I mean, the book they had great problems with, but they went wild when a movie crew came to my hometown, or what we then claimed as our hometown, Beaufort, South Carolina, where the Great Santini took place. And my mother got to teach Blythe Danner how to use the rosary, and my father got to walk around with Robert Duvall. And so they even though they were divorced at this time, they loved the fact that their lives were important enough to be portrayed by great actors and actresses. And it was odd seeing, there's a scene in The Great Santini, the movie, where I'm watching it with my father, I'm watching it being filmed, and there's somebody playing Dad, and there's somebody playing me running around. Blythe Danner playing my mother is sitting in the stands. Directly behind Blythe Danner is my real mother. They put in as an extra. And on the basketball court, playing with the guy playing with me, is one of my brothers playing on the basketball team. So we really mixed, we had a collage of all this when that movie was being made. But it certainly reconciled them to the book.
Did that make it easier for you to write more autobiographical work?
You know, the one thing is I never asked permission to write. You know, since it's my life, too, I always figure if I lived it and they were around, and it's, you know, you hate hurting people, you hate, you know, putting them in a situation, you hate writing about stuff that they don't like you to write about, but, you know, if I'm going to be honest as a writer, if I'm going to have any sort of credibility as a writer, I like pulling these things out of my life that have affected me, that have given me moments of great pain or great joy. I mean, this seems to be the material of every writer's life. And I love hearing writers say, no, this is completely made up, it's a composite. With my own life, I have to say, no, this is very close to me. This happened to me. These were people I knew. Because if I don't, I feel like I'm lying, like my mother used to do. I feel like I'm denying, like my mother used to do. And this is part of the reason I write, because I want to celebrate these people. I want to celebrate them with all their warts and flaws and glorious parts.
Why do you want to celebrate your father? You said your mother should have left him 4 days after they were married.
You know, because Dad was a jerk. I mean, but he's an honest jerk. As I look at the guy, the one thing that I came to the conclusion was that amazed me in that book is that Dad, though he beat us, though he screamed at us, though he was horrible to us, he loved us in this stupid, dim-witted way, this bovine way of his. He simply had, like many men in our country, he had no vocabulary for love. He had no emotional context for love. He had never been loved. His parents had treated him as coldly as you can treat anybody. Dad simply did not know how to do it, and he didn't know how to do it now.
My guest is Pat Conroy, author of the current bestseller, The Prince of Tides. His novels, The Great Santini and The Lords of Discipline, have both been made into films. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Pat Conroy is my guest, and his novels include The Great Santini and The Prince of Tides, which is his new novel. Your novel, The Lords of Discipline, is based on going to cadet school.
Right.
Did you want to go?
No, but that's, once again, Dad did not ask me if I wanted to play football, nor did he ask me where I wanted to go to college. He simply said, "You're going to the Citadel, son." It's Military College of South Carolina. So he sent me to the Citadel, and after plebe week, and I think a week later, they let us call home for the first time. So Mom answered, and I was crying. I said, you know, as soon as I heard her voice, I just simply broke down. I said, "Mom, you have sent me to a torture chamber. What is this nonsense? I'm supposed to go to college, drink beer, I mean, meet people and have fun." So Mom cried. Dad got on the other end. I said, "Mom, I'm coming home." Dad said, in that charming voice of his, "Where's home, son?" So I said, "Dad, I don't care what you say, I'm getting out of here." And Dad said in this line, he said, "Son, if you leave that school, you're a pansy." He left not much choice at that particular time. So I graduated.
What kind of discipline were you exposed to?
Well, they, you know, this is the, I think the plebe system at the Citadel was the toughest plebe system in the country at that particular time. I hear they've cleaned it up. There's a lot of hazing. There was, you know, a tremendous amount of screaming, even, you know, not letting the cadets eat at mess. And I'll tell you, it was an interesting milieu for a novelist. It was like being in Dante's Inferno for a year of my life.
When you were in cadet school, were you already interested in writing?
Yeah, I was very interested in writing. My mother raised me to be a writer for some odd, strange reason. She was, you know, my father was from Chicago. My mother was from a very, very southern family. I mean, a very poor family. And my mother, for some reason, got into her head that Southerners made the best writers. My mother loved to read. And from a very early age, she told me she wanted me to be a writer. Now, when she got interviewed a couple years before she died, and they said, "When did you know Pat was going to be a writer?" And my mother, with her great sense of style and drama, said, "I knew it when the nurse brought him to my bed the day he was born." I said, "Mom, if that was true, why didn't you name me some great name like Rutledge, Ravenel, Conroy, or why Pat?" And my mother said, "You've never understood the elegance of simplicity." But she got it in her head that I was going to do this, and she never had any doubts. She never told me why, and it didn't surprise me when she got angry when I did it.
Well, I bet the cadet school you were in wasn't known for its writing program.
The writing program was not strong. I can honestly tell you that. I think they're still astonished that they've produced. They seem kind of proud of it, even though they were furious with the Lords of Discipline. They seem sort of inordinately proud that I am a novelist, that the school did produce me. They even use me in brochures. You know, not only do we create great military leaders, we create artists, novelists. It rather tickles me.
It's funny that with all this Marine training that neither you nor any of your brothers became Marines.
Dad had 5 sons that did not spend one day in the military. I said, "Dad, does it tell you anything?" And he said, "Nope."
You not only didn't serve in the Marines, but you didn't want to serve in the Vietnam War.
No, Vietnam War. I was against the Vietnam War.
So you got a teaching deferment. Taught in a small school on a Georgia Sea Island?
Well, that came later. I taught first in Beaufort, South Carolina. I was a teacher and a coach in Beaufort, South Carolina for the first 2 years out of the Citadel. Then I accepted a job on Dufusky Island, South Carolina, the third year. And after that, I was fired, and I retired from teaching forever.
And that last experience was the basis of
The Water is Wide.
Water is Wide.
Exactly.
Which was made into the film Conrad.
Right.
Why were you fired?
Gross neglect of duty, insubordination, conduct unbecoming a professional educator, and AWOL. I might as well have gone into the military.
Boy, but you were really on your own and fighting back.
Yes, this was not a good time in my life. And I came up against, when I went to this island, it was the first year of teacher integration in South Carolina. So I was integration. I was the only, you know, white person in this school. So I went over there and taught grades 5 through 8 and found out that the kids didn't know what country they lived in, didn't know what state they lived in. One of them, the one thing they thought, that Savannah, Georgia was the largest city in the world, which is okay. I can deal with that. They thought Bluffton, South Carolina was the second largest city. And I realized I had come across this island of innocence and neglect. These kids simply had not been taught. Attention had not been paid to these children. So the first day of school, I wrote the superintendent of school and said that your school's a garbage dump and we all ought to be ashamed of ourselves. And that was the beginning of the end with me and the superintendent. So it turned out to be a fascinating year, but it ended with my early retirement from teaching. And there was a trial, and I lost, and eventually I wrote The Water Is Wide.
Did your failure as a teacher launch your career as a writer?
I guess it did. I don't think that, you know, I'd written a book first about this commandant at Citadel who we called the book, and he got fired. And I said, why'd you get fired? You're the only guy that was nice in the whole place. And I wrote his stories down. He had these great stories of this military college over the years. And I got started like this. I don't know if you're interested in writing, but I knew nothing about writing or getting published. You know, at Citadel, we didn't have a creative writing teacher. We had none of this writer-in-residence stuff. So I just had never met a writer at this particular time in my life. And I guess it was, the Boo was sitting on his bed on the Citadel campus, smoking a cigar, and he said, Bubba, you're an English major. Now, at the Citadel, this meant, this is almost an open admission, you were gay at the Citadel. They had so few English majors, I can't even tell you. But he said, you're an English major, Bubba. How do we get a book published? I said, Colonel, I have no idea at all. And this is true. He smoked a cigar and he said, let's look in the Yellow Pages. So he got the Charleston Yellow Pages. He looked, Terry, in the Yellow Pages, under printing, there was a company that said, business cards, invitations, books. I went down. The guy said, sure, we'll publish your book. $1,500. I went to Willie Shepherd at the Bank of Beaufort, who was a Citadel graduate. I said, Willie, I'm doing this book on the Citadel. Need some money? Well, he gave me the $1,500, and that's how I got published the first time.
And the second time? Because that was self-published. How'd you
that was self-published. Well, I thought I was going to do it the second time, too. I was going to write this book on Dufusky Island. And as I was writing the book furiously, and I was enraged, I wanted to explain to this town why I was fired. I was simply writing in a white heat. I was so angry at the superintendent. I was so enraged at this entire situation. So I am writing every day. And a writer came through town who had heard about my getting fired. Newsweek did an article about my getting fired. And this guy came through and said, you need a New York agent. So he gave me the name of Julian Bach, who I called. And I said, Mr. Bach, I'm from Pat Conroy from Beaufort, South Carolina. I think I have this wonderful idea. He said, get off the phone. What are you doing? And out of courtesy to this writer, he said he'd look at the manuscript. Now, I cannot tell you how small Beaufort is or how innocent I was in those days. I was so excited that I had a New York agent, not even knowing what that was. All my friends raced over, and my wife handed them out a chapter at a time and said, Pat's got a New York agent. They flew off with these, and each of them typed it overnight, where I had a manuscript the next day. I had forgotten to tell them. Some did it on onion skin paper, some did it on yellow paper, some did it on line paper, different kind of typewriters. Well, Julian, of course, gets this and thinks little Abner is now in his stable. He thought it was the most adorable, cute, rural thing that had ever happened to him in his life. He just melted. So he accepts a manuscript, takes it to Houghton Mifflin, calls me up 3 weeks later and says, I've got great news. Houghton Mifflin has agreed to publish your book. And here's the great news. And he says, $7,500. And, of course, I said, in my innocence, in the line that he repeats, I'd say 100 times a week, Julian, I don't think Willie Shepherd down at Beaufort Bank is going to lend me $7,500. Julian, in stunned silence, then says, Pat, you realize they pay you, you don't pay them. And that was my first lesson in publishing, and that's when I think my career actually started.
Novelist Pat Conroy is my guest. His new novel is titled The Prince of Tides. He's also the writer of The Great Santini. I'm under the impression that the Prince of Tides is a much darker exploration of the kinds of emotional problems that parents can cause than The Great Santinias, which has a certain irony and detachment
and charm
about it. Yeah.
There's a certain charm to dad's beating his wife. There was, I realized when I wrote The Great Santini, I had not told the story of my family. That I had denied and had lied as much as I had always blamed my mother for doing. So I wanted to get into the heart of darkness of our family. And I thought if I did, it's probably true of most families. You know, usually when I meet people and I talk to people, a family can be a dark chronicle. And a family, you know, if you start scratching the surface, a family can be a very, very tough thing. You know, I was very surprised when I got married that I was no good at it. I just was not a good husband. Then I realized, of course you're not a good husband. Look who your model was. Of course you're not a good father. Look at the only father you've ever seen raise children. So to break those things, to break those bonds of the past, it's necessary for me to dive into the wreck to find out what it is and to see if I can discover what the truth of that family is. And I still haven't done it. I mean, there's still things in the family that, I mean, my brothers and sisters have been helpful to me because they said, yes, there was damage. They have been honest about that. Yes, we came from a screwed up family. Yes, mom was screwed up. Dad was screwed up. Yes, it got to us all. And then I was, and why I love my family so much is when mom died, we just came apart. I mean, my family simply came apart at the seams. And where I thought I'd be a Gary Cooper-like figure, you know, yes, mom's gone. It surprised me. I just, I did backflips. I leapt on mom. I went under the bed, around, slithered around like a snake in the floor. I just simply went crazy at the actual time she died. And it was that coming apart and then that coming together as a family whenever a death comes in that affected me a great deal. And I realized I was glad that we were an emotional family and a passionate family. And that's one thing mom's death did, and it brought it all together. And after mom died, I could then go back and finish this book.
How do you think your children will describe your family?
You know, imagine, I said, you know, with my kids, the one thing with my kids, I do a little thing in the book about the way I've raised my kids, is I've joked with my kids. I say, kids, I'm screwing you up. I don't know how I'm doing it. I am screwing you up badly. You'll be in a psychiatrist's office because of me. Now, I wouldn't do it if I knew I was doing it, but I'm a parent. I can't help it. So I'm screwing you up, so it's your job to sort of listen to me, pretend you're doing what I'm saying, but lead a secret life where you're your own person, doing your own thing. And that's the best advice I can give you. And of course, now, since they're my children, they go, oh, Dad, please shut up. Be quiet, Dad. This again, Dad. So I have not changed this thing with kids at all, but I have simply tried to tell them that, you know, my way is not the only way, and they're going to have to do the best they can. I just can't be one of these parents that can pretend he knows what to do.
Pat Conroy has been my guest. His current bestseller, The Prince of Tides, is published in paperback by Bantam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk about terrorism with Richard Falk. He's a professor of international law at Princeton University and the author of the new book, Revolutionaries and Functionaries, The Dual Face of Terrorism. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with Irish rock pianist and singer Pierce Turner. His first solo album has the lyricism of Irish ballads driven by a New York dance beat. Composer Philip Glass co-produced the album and did the string arrangements. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's Broadway hit Into the Woods. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses the new book They Have a Word for It, a collection of foreign words and expressions for which there are no ready English translations. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Lyason. Algiers Radio reports some progress today in talks between Algerian government officials and pro-Iranian hijackers. The gunmen are holding some 35 hostages in a siege that began 9 days ago. More from Barnaby Mason in Algiers.
The Algerian Interior Minister, El Hadi Khediri, said after going aboard the airliner soon after it arrived from Cyprus that the hijackers had promised not to use violence in Algiers. Algerian officials have been on board during the day talking to the hijackers, but precisely what about, we don't know. Earlier optimism that the release of 12 more hostages in Cyprus and the move to Algiers meant a quick end to the ordeal of the others has somewhat receded. The hijackers haven't abandoned their demand for the release of 17 Islamic militants imprisoned in Kuwait. Assuming they did agree to release all the hostages, the most difficult issue must be what happens to the hijackers themselves, given that they've already murdered two people on the plane. But it's certain that the Algerians, with a record of bringing off delicate negotiations in the past, will do everything possible to avoid further violence.
The BBC's Barnaby Mason. For a second night in a row, U.S. Marines fired on intruders at an American military base in Panama. The two-hour firefight at a fuel storage area near Howard Air Force Base began after 40 or 50 infiltrators were spotted by Marine sentries. No casualties were reported. On Monday night, Marine Corporal Ricardo Villahermosa was accidentally shot to death by fellow Marines on patrol after several intruders were spotted. The U.S. Southern Command cannot confirm Defense Department speculation that Panamanian soldiers were involved in the fighting. President Reagan today commented for the first time on the controversy stirred up by a book written by former White House spokesman Larry Speaks. Among other things, Speaks says he fabricated quotes from the president to give to the media during the 1985 Geneva summit, and that he later told the president, who did not object. Today, in a speech to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, the president told a different story. NPR's Jim Engel has details.
Mr. Reagan said today Speaks did not tell him of the fabricated quotes, and an irritated president made clear his displeasure.
I was not aware of that and just learned it recently, as all the rest of you did, and the words in his book, and I can tell you right now that I have no affection for these kiss-and-tell books that are being written, and I find them entirely fiction.
That response came in answer to a question. Earlier in prepared remarks, the president said, as he started to tell a story he'd told before, that one of the nice things about being president is that you can quote yourself shamelessly, and if you don't, he said, Larry Speaks will. Mr. Reagan also disputed the impression given by Speaks' book that the president rarely reads the newspaper and relies instead on news summaries prepared by the White House. Mr. Reagan confirmed one of Speaks' assertions that he does begin reading the paper by turning to the comics, but said Speaks is wrong when he implies that I don't read the papers. I'm Jim Engel in Washington.
A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine shows that smoking sharply increases a woman's chances of having a stroke. Dr. Lewis Kaplan, chief of neurology of the New England Medical Center, said that although the connection between cigarettes and strokes is not news, this study clearly established the connection in women for the first time.
There was an old study that showed that if you smoked and took birth control pills, your risk of subarachnoid hemorrhage was much higher than if you did neither of those things. In this study, they also corroborated that the risk of subarachnoid hemorrhage was high if you smoked, but also the risk of blocking off blood vessels is high.
The study also shows that quitting smoking quickly reduces the risk of suffering a stroke. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 2107.10. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Stephen Sondheim is practically the only contemporary Broadway composer whose musical and literary ambitions go beyond the stock Broadway formulas for success. It's begun to pay off. In 1985, Sondheim won a Pulitzer Prize in drama for his musical Sunday in the Park with George. His latest show, Into the Woods, is one of his biggest hits. Lloyd has a review of the new original cast album, and he's a little worried that Sondheim may be getting somewhat predictable. Here's an excerpt from the recording.
Into the woods, it's time to go. I hate to leave, I have to, though. Into the woods, it's time, and so I must begin my journey. Into the woods and through the trees to where I am expected, ma'am. Into the woods to grandmother's house. Into the woods to grandmother's house.
You're certain of your way?
The way is clear. I have no fear, nor no one should. The woods are just trees, the trees are just wood. I sort of hate to ask it, but do you have a basket? Into the woods and down the dell, the path is straight, I know it well. Into the woods and who can tell what's waiting on the journey? Into the woods to bring some bread to Granny who is sick in bed. Never can tell what lies ahead, for all that I know she's already dead. But into the woods, into the woods, into the woods, to grandmother's house and home before dark.
Into the Woods, like most of Stephen Sondheim's musicals, has an intriguing premise to match its intriguing title. It takes a handful of familiar fairy tales, some of them rather grim, updates them, and watches what happens when the characters interact. There's Jack, of Bean and Beanstalk fame, a little Red Riding Hood who is surprisingly aroused by the wolf, and the baker's wife is so eager to be, as she says, in Cinderella's shoes that she has an affair with Prince Charming. Sondheim isn't the first composer to give fairy tales a modern slant, but his classy combination of tricky wordplay and musical sophistication sounds like no one but Sondheim. Listen to Jack's mother's description of their old cow.
There are bugs on her dugs. There are flies in her eyes. There's a lump on her rump, big enough to be a hump.
But
son, we've no time to sit and dither while her withers wither with her.
Or Prince Charming's facile seduction of the baker's wife.
Life is often so unpleasant, you must know that as a peasant, best to take the moment present as a present for the moment.
I think the deepest source of Sondheim's musical energy is parody. In his very best shows, beginning with A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and including Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, and Pacific Overtures, his music takes off from pre-existing forms. Vaudeville routines, 50s girl trios, Viennese waltzes, he's a veritable Broadway Brahms, even kabuki. Yet in his very imitations, Sondheim is capable of exploring the most moving and complex feelings. As a Noel Coward character once said, extraordinary how potent cheap music is. The problem with Sondheim recently may be that his musical sources aren't cheap enough. Since Sweeney Todd, his ambitiousness has gotten hard to separate from pretentiousness. The more operatic he gets, the further behind he leaves his tight forms, his sharp edge, and his originality. More and more, Sondheim's new shows feel like variations on his own old ones. A nasty duet for two rival lovers in Into the Woods is an awful lot like the one in A Little Night Music. Cinderella is as afraid to make up her mind as Amy in Company. Relationships fall apart for almost exactly the same reasons they fall apart in other Sondheim shows, self-consciousness and self-delusion. When in Follies he called the God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do, I'll see you later blues. Even the ambiguous endings have begun to seem predictable, calculated, and underlined. Still, Into the Woods is probably Sondheim's best score since Sweeney Todd. The title song is a neat Disney parody. The juicy No One Is Alone is a cross between Rodgers and Hammerstein's You'll Never Walk Alone and Being Alive, the just this side of sentimental conclusion of Company. It may be Sondheim's prettiest ballad since Send in the Clowns.
Someone is on your side.
Our side.
Our side.
Someone else is not.
While we're seeing our side.
Our side.
Maybe we forgot.
They
just don't let it go.
Things will come out right now. We can make it so. Someone is on your side. No one is alone.
If the tunes aren't as memorable as they used to be, at least the accompaniments have a new chamber music delicacy. The cast itself is fine, maybe a little anonymous, except for Bernadette Peters, who's terrific as the witch from next door. She helps make The Last Midnight Sondheim's most enjoyably chilling post-nuclear existentialist waltz in several seasons.
It's the
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the original cast recording of Into the Woods on RCA Records. This is Fresh Air. Pierce Turner came from Ireland to New York 10 years ago looking for adventure. The young rock pianist and singer played the New York downtown clubs with his band The Major Thinkers. Pierce Turner has been on his own now for the last few years and has just released his first solo album on RCA called It's Only a Long Way Across. The album was recorded in Philip Glass's studio and was produced by Glass and Glass's longtime collaborator Kurt Mukasey. Turner's music has been influenced by American rock and soul, as well as by the ballads of his native Ireland.
Spring still paints fire escapes with pauper shade. Radios rapid screech like trains. Our figures floating through the sewing set. Some guy walks by suspended by the sky.
I guess it's a really lucky break on your first album to have Philip Glass co-producing and arranging the strings. How did you first meet Philip Glass?
I met Philip in the way that you would meet any person, really. I just through an acquaintance. And, we became friends, but it took a while to develop an artistic relationship. Eventually, though, it came to a point where it made sense to ask him to do this album.
He arranged the strings on your album. And I think so frequently in any form of pop music, strings are there for sweetening. Which isn't the way they're used on your record. What was it his suggestion to use strings, and what was your initial reaction to the idea?
My whole thing about strings is that I'm not interested in them being sweeteners at all. I think a synthesizer is actually a far better sweetener instrument than strings. I have always really admired driving strings and the way Beethoven used strings and the way George Martin for the Beatles used strings. So that's what I really wanted from Philip. And from the word go, I told him that. And he is the kind of gentleman that you can actually say something like that to, and he can really go for it, you know. And it wasn't a question of, oh, I'm a superstar, don't tell me what to do. He was very interested in nailing exactly what I wanted.
'Twas early in the month of July. It was one of those days when the blue bled the sky. And the sun shone gold on the eve of the day.
one of the things I really am exploring and I find really comfortable to do is to sing in a very legato fashion where I really stretch the notes out in long, long, long holes. But I like the undercurrent to really move along at a fast pace. I like the backing to really move along behind me. And How It Shone is a good example because it's about 118 beats per minute, which is as fast as any dance song that you're going to hear on the radio. But it sounds like a ballad the way I sing it.
You play piano on some tracks and synthesizer on others. You must have started off playing piano before learning synthesizer?
Yeah, definitely.
Did you have to figure out if a synthesizer was going to be an instrument that you wanted to use, and if so, what you were going to do with it?
Well, yeah, the thing is that being a keyboard player was always way too restrictive for me, and I was always an experimental keyboard player. I was never trained to be a keyboard player. And just my sister showed me how to play the chords on the piano when I was about 13 or 14, and I was really taken by the instrument. But immediately I stuffed newspaper into the strings so that they would buzz and stuff like that. So when I heard about the synthesizer, I immediately said, I must have this thing. I mean, I heard this thing, and I thought, well, this is just perfect because, you know, I was a frustrated keyboard player in that I couldn't get it to do enough wild things for me anyhow.
You're from Ireland, from Wexford?
Yes, Wexford, Ireland.
Do you feel like you've taken anything musically from Ireland in either your singing, your playing, or your songwriting?
Oh, definitely. I mean, growing up in Ireland, in a place where there's not a sky in the clouds instead of a cloud in the sky. I mean, it's just a strange experience. It's a very dark experience, and people from Ireland aren't dark, but they have an overtone of darkness to them. But they're very cynical and very witty, and also they love slow songs. You know, I mean, Irish people just never stop singing slow songs. You have a sing song in a bar. I mean, it's like you feel like committing suicide when you leave the bar. And I mean, I couldn't help but really absorb that.
Well, I saw you last night. Once again inside my eyes. In the world of fabrication we call dreams. You went standing in the weeds down by.
Do you think you've taken that kind of slow singing and backed it with more of a dance beat?
Definitely, because even though I was being raised in that atmosphere, I actually rejected Irish music entirely when I was growing up there because it represented a different age group and it represented Irish traditionalism and nationalism, and I wasn't interested in that. As a youth, I was interested in being a rock and roll star or something like that. But now I'm interested in all that stuff, and I appreciate all that stuff now. But what I was interested in at the time was people like Otis Redding and American soul. So I absorbed a lot of American soulful rhythms, a lot of the rhythms of that music, and that fascinated me. And I think that unwillingly, I was absorbing all this Irish stuff too, and now I think all that stuff's starting to come together, a combination of Irish lyricism and American soul in some weird way.
Now, you had a partner in Ireland named Larry Kerwin, mm-hmm. and you moved with him to America
to
get established here. What made you decide, okay, it's time now, we're getting out?
Well, we weren't too clear about this. We were pretty young, you know. We weren't too smart. It wasn't like we sat down and said, now, this sounds like a really good move. In fact, this is one of the things I really found out a difference between myself and, say, the Beatles or any band or any artist that really makes it in a big way, that they really do think about these things. If I go to America, then I will, you know, get a record deal this way and all that stuff. I didn't think that way. We came here for adventure. We came to check this country out, to see what this amazing place was that we'd seen so many films about, and we were very curious about it.
You know, your new record is a really different sound from a record that you had a few years ago called Avenue B.
Mm-hmm.
Describe what you were doing on Avenue B.
Avenue B is a, you know, is a product of us rehearsing on Avenue B. The band Major Thinkers, we rehearsed in a very, very dingy rehearsal studio there.
This is Avenue B in Manhattan?
Yeah, Avenue B, yeah, in Manhattan, yeah, at Lower East Side. And we were playing there, and we were just having fun, really, and we said Avenue B is the place to be. If you want to find me, come to Avenue B, you know. And we just thought that was really funny, and it was. We started fooling around with that and jamming on that idea, you know, ding, 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 you know, just, and the rhythms that are on there are very influenced by the Spanish people in the neighborhood. I mean, they're always playing the beer cans and hitting them, and you can just always hear drums in that neighborhood.
Did you put out the record independently?
Yeah, we put it. We couldn't get a record deal, but Epic Records were interested in us. And at this point now, we were starting to get smart. We were starting to get strategies together and understand the game. And what we did was we simply sent the record to an Irish record company who we knew, and we knew they would put it out. Then we had it imported to America. This was all the plan, by the way. Was imported to America by Important Records, and then immediately we thought radio stations would like what we had to say. You know, record companies said, "Oh no, they'll never play it in the radio," and the radio stations got it and played it.
So you really did get smart.
We got what? Yeah, we got smart. Yeah, and I'm getting smarter all the time.
Pierce Turner's debut album is called "It's Only a Long Way Across." On April 23rd, Turner begins a national tour, opening for the Smithereens. You're listening to Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, today the Massachusetts legislature passed Governor Dukakis's big health care plan. That's a plan that would provide health care for all in the state. And we have a report on that, and also what presidential candidate Dukakis and his Democratic rivals have in mind for health care if they should, any one of them should become president. Last week, a congressional committee held several days of hearings on drug traffic from Central America and the Caribbean into the United States. Today, we asked the chairman of the committee, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, if he thinks high U.S. officials were aware that drug money went to fund the Contras, and he says he thinks they knew.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up in All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts about a new book titled They Have a Word for It. It's a collection of foreign words and phrases for which we have no simple English translation.
We all know the bittersweet feeling that stirs in us when we encounter someone we no longer love. Well, the Russians have a word for it, razblyuto. Razblyuto is one of several hundred foreign expressions collected by Howard Rheingold in a new book called They Have a Word for It, published by Jeremy Tarcher, which is described as a lexicon of untranslatable words and phrases. There are a lot of words you can't translate from one language to another, of course, most often because the concept is particular to a certain culture. It's not surprising that the native languages of Borneo have no word for alimony, or for that matter, that the French have no word for squeeze play. And by the same token, you wouldn't expect English to have an equivalent for the New Guinea word biditilulo, which means something like ritual boasting about the size of one's yams. The interesting untranslatables are the words that denote a concept that is already familiar to us, but which we've never gotten around to acknowledging with a name of its own. They Have a Word for It is full of provocative examples. Take the French expression contre coeur, which means against the wishes of the heart. If you say, she married him contre coeur, you imply that she didn't love him. It would be a useful expression to have around in English. We can say against one's better judgment to talk about actions that ignore the voice of the intellect, but we have no ready way to describe actions that defy the pull of emotion. Several of the best words that Rheingold gives involve the nuances of screwing up. There's the French noun gâchis, which refers to a spectacularly bungled opportunity, like Gary Hart's presidential run. Then there's the Yiddish word fapachkit, which describes the way things get fouled up when people try to fix them. The Watergate cover-up was brilliantly for Patzkit, for example. And finally, German gives us the noun Schlimmbesserung, which refers to an improvement that makes things worse, like the bus lanes on the freeways, the new simplified tax forms, or those push-button wristwatches that require two hands to tell the time. Many of these words seem so useful that you can imagine them being imported into English someday, just as we imported schlemiel and déjà vu earlier on. But therein lies the paradox of this book. Words like schlemiel and déjà vu must have been delightful discoveries when we English speakers first encountered them and took them to our linguistic breasts. But now they're just old flames, and we feel for them only the pangs of razbiuto. Reading through They Have a Word for It, in fact, I got to thinking about all the native English words that you might want to include in a foreign edition of this book. Take smug, a word that has no equivalent in any other language I know of. You could define smugness as the complacent self-satisfaction of people who believe they have a privileged access to moral truth. Or consider the untranslatable word cozy, which you might explain as the property of spaces that evokes the sensation of emotional warmth and protectedness. The French and Japanese find cozy a delightful word. If a little hard to grasp, it's just so English. When you spell the definitions out like that, they make us sound like a wonderfully insightful people. But of course, we never stop to reflect on any of this. We take the meanings of cozy and smug for granted. To give a name to something is to take its conceptual virginity. It becomes common, an idea that anybody could have. Reading Rheingold's book, we can re-experience the seductive thrill of linguistic first encounters.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. On the next show, I'll speak with character comedian Eugene Levy on the SCTV comedy series. Levy created the character of Mr. Show Business himself, Bobby Bittman. Levy brings Bittman back for a new HBO comedy special. Rock critic Ken Tucker will review three albums by black male vocalists trying their hands at new genres or trying to extend the traditions they first performed in. The artists are Howard Hewitt, John Whitehead, and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Beetlejuice, the new comedy about a couple that remodels a Victorian home, only to find that it's inhabited by ghosts who abhor their urban chicness. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.